I'm delighted now to welcome Dr. Emil Nakhle. He is a retired senior intelligence officer in the CIA, where he was director of its Political Islam Strategic Analysis Program. He is the author of the book A Necessary Engagement, Reinventing America's Relations with the Muslim World, which is published by Princeton. And he is also in a new book. He has a chapter in a new book called Combating Transnational Terrorism, Searching for a New Paradigm, which was published last month by Prager Publishers. And this Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, he will be giving a lecture, which is part of the Santa Fe Council on International Relations series called The Muslim World and Beyond. He'll be talking about political Islam. That's at Santa Fe Prep on Saturday morning. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
So let's talk about global terrorism. Global terrorism is, in many people's minds, associated with Islam, which is certainly not the only perpetrator of terrorism in the world. But who are the perpetrators when you talk about this giant category called global terrorism, and who are the victims in the 21st century?
Well, actually, I will begin with the second question first. The victims are both Muslims and non-Muslims, even though many of those who have committed terrorism in the last 20 years, let's say, most of them have committed terrorism in the name of Islam, of course, a perversion of their religion, but they committed terrorism against both Muslims and non-Muslims. 9/11 is one of those heinous crimes that was committed against the United States, of course. But the victims in New York were from so many countries and so many different nationalities and religions.
So that is some of the victims of terrorism, but of course it's not limited to the United States or indeed Western countries.
That is true. In fact, we've had in the last 10 years terrorist acts committed in, not as you said, not in in Western countries only, but in Egypt, in Sudan, in Indonesia, in Turkey, in a number of other Muslim countries as well. So their acts have been against what they call the traditional crusaders, the infidels, headed by the United States, against international Zionism headed by Israel, and against pro-Western regimes, mostly Islamic regimes, who in their view are un-Islamic in their behavior. So they are targeted. This is what we call the near enemy and the far enemy, what the radicals have described as the near enemy and the far enemy. But what is interesting and what is, of course, encouraging in the last 2 years, and certainly this past year, is that we have seen more and more rejection of this paradigm, of this terrorist logic, if you will, by Muslims themselves. And that is a very encouraging sign. And we actually, it is possible to argue that Al-Qaeda, which represents this radical paradigm, seems to be on the wane. And this is not just wishful thinking, but I believe we have indications to show that Al-Qaeda is finding it difficult to recruit new recruits, to raise funds, and to establish contacts with other like-minded organizations. So we have seen a diffusion of this radical mass, if you will, but we really have seen a rejection, open rejection in the media, in Muslim media, of this radical paradigm only very recently.
Which is very interesting, and I want to talk about that more in a few minutes. But let's stay for a moment with these, the people who are terrorists, who carry out terrorist actions, who are involved in a whole set of ideologies. What are their who are they? What are their motivations? Why do they get into this kind of work, this kind of life?
Right. This is, of course, a very good question, and without boring your audience with history, it in fact started, at least this phase of Islamic terrorism, started by Osama bin Laden in the early 90s against of of foreign troops in Saudi Arabia. That was after the first Gulf War, when we went in and evicted Saddam Hussein from Kuwait, and then our forces stayed in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Qatar and Abu Dhabi and so and Oman. And so Osama bin Laden said that Arabia, being the holy land of Islam, shall have only one religion, and that's Islam. It's based on a questionable statement by the Prophet Muhammad. But in fact, that's how it started, and therefore it continued focusing on policies. That is, they began to identify our support for Israel, our attacks on Muslim countries such as Iraq and Afghanistan, and more recently Pakistan, and our support, as I said, support for Israel and anti, in their view, anti-Palestinian policies, our bellicose rhetoric toward Iran and Syria. So they use all of these issues and tied them all together, saying that, well, this is the Islamic cause. And so it moved from those very specific policies to an ideological or religious, narrow religious interpretation of that ideology to say that this war between their brand of Islam and non-Muslims shall last forever until the final days when Islam will emerge victorious. So they gave it kind of a religious undertones, but that the fact is it started with a specific identification of policies, you know, rightly or wrongly, but they began on policies first and then moved from there to a so-called religious ideology.
One can have sympathy, if one looks at these things with clear eyes, with some of those objections to U.S. or Western policy. But the methods, namely the methods of terrorism, are very hard to have sympathy with. Why were those methods, as opposed to direct other kinds of nonviolent political protest or political engagement,
right,
chosen?
Well, that's again another very good question, and briefly, the answer to that is that in a number of Muslim countries, unfortunately, they continue to have authoritarian, autocratic regimes, whether in Egypt or Saudi Arabia or Yemen or Tunisia. So those regimes have not allowed for any political organization, Islamic and secular. That is, there's no opposition, no political opposition is allowed in those countries. So the fact is that Islamic groups, and in fact even liberal groups, secular liberal groups that opposed U.S. policy in those countries, could not organize, could not speak out in public, and so they either fell silent or the radicals opted for violence and terrorism because they no longer believed in what they called a gradual change or changing their political systems from within under the law. The opportunity was not there, so the majority fell silent, and that radical minority pursued terrorism as a vehicle of change.
It's not only that there were autocratic political regimes and so on, but also a lot of these people were young men who really saw no future for themselves, for any kind of economic place in the world, marriage, family, and so on, and that leads people to desperate measures.
Well, that is exactly true, because when you look at the what we call the drivers of radicalism, that is the factors that have contributed, and we have studied that very closely in the last 20 years, not only as part of my job, but in dealing with other academics on this issue, that we've identified at least half a dozen key factors that have contributed to or have driven radicalism. One, of course, is the autocratic regimes and their policies of repression. Two, policies of corruption, poor economic policies, increased poverty the changing demographics, whereby the population has become younger, less educated, poorer, and therefore more alienated. And so you have a tremendous growth in the population, and yet you don't have sufficient economic opportunity to that would provide the young people, especially high school graduates, with any kind of hope for either to get married or to buy a house or to pursue a decent job. So these issues have certainly contributed to the growth of radicalism. And when I was talking to a couple of kids in Pakistan several years back, and I asked them why they were going to do jihad in Kashmir, well, they told me that's a way out. We get a gun, we get money, and we go places. Otherwise, what would we do staying in this little village here?
It does really make one rethink ways to fight terrorism, and it seems like creating grassroots economic opportunity would be far more effective than all the guns in the world.
Well, that's exactly right, and frankly, please forgive me, that is exactly why I wrote this book that you cited in the introduction. And that is that the book argues two, three points which are key to it. And one is that a vast majority of Muslims, they do not support terrorism. That is, those who engage in terrorism tend to be a small minority, and this is by confirmed in public opinion polls over in recent years, the Pew poll, the Gallup poll, and a few other polls. Secondly, that we need to engage the vast majority of Muslims on issues that are not necessarily political, as you indicated, educational opportunities, economic opportunities, health issues, the rule of law, things that judicial reform, technological education in their schools, school curricula. So there are many areas that we can engage the vast majority of Muslims throughout the world. And the third point I argued is that engaging these millions of Muslims, the 98%, I call it, you know, the 199%, the 1% of terrorism and the 99% of Muslims who just, you know, live and let live and they want to live. And they have children to educate, they have mortgages to pay, bills to pay, and so on. So the third point I argue that is that engaging these vast majorities of Muslims is a matter of national interest. That is, it is our country's national interest dictates that we not ignore the 1.2 or 1.3 billion Muslims and just focus on terrorism, because as the previous administration unfortunately has done, they painted the whole Islamic world with a broad brush of terrorism, which gave the impression to most Muslims that our policies, our pursuit of terrorism, really equated with anti-Islamic policy. And so they resented that and they rejected that. And so engaging the Islamic world, I argue, is that it will give the clear impression that we are differentiating between terrorism and the rest, that we are viewing terrorists as criminals and as a group of people that should be pursued and stopped, but that to win, if you will, I hate to use the phrase, the hearts and minds of vast majorities of Muslims, we need to engage them on all kinds of levels, not necessarily at the regime level, but at the society level. Civil society institutions, high school and grade school teachers associations, women's groups, small business groups, small young clerics, and so political parties. So there are a number of indigenous, credible groups that we can engage in order really to defeat terrorism, because as you correctly indicated, we cannot truly reach the Islamic world through the gun. We have to use the gun against the terrorists, but that we need to engage in other social and economic and educational and medical issues, health issues.
We're talking to Dr. Emil Nakle. He's a retired senior intelligence officer from the CIA. His earlier book is called A Necessary Engagement, Reinventing America's Relations with the Muslim World. I think it's interesting that you write in your latest article in the book, Combating Transnational Terrorism, that it's extremely important to do international intelligence sharing. So intelligence sharing not only among countries in the Western world, but also between the United States and Western countries and the Muslim world. But because of our behavior, because of Guantanamo, and because of, as you say, painting the Muslim world with a broad brush in a very negative light, and the extreme rendition and so on, all these things that we've done, people don't necessarily want to cooperate with us.
That is true. That actually happened in recent years. But the other side of that is that some of those intelligence agencies, which of course are an extension of their regimes, cooperated with us for very narrow personal reasons, that is, to serve the interests and the survival of their regimes. So that's a point that we had to keep in mind, that while they were cooperating with us, I guess, they were doing that for their own benefits and their own self-interest. However, what has happened in this past year, particularly since the president's speech in Cairo on June 4, and some of the comments he made in Turkey to the Turkish parliament before that, but his speech in Cairo gave the clear impression that we are making a distinction between the terrorists and the rest of the Muslim world, and that, too, we have a lot of common characteristics, a kind of a single theme, common ground between us and other cultures and other religions, the interest in justice, fairness, mutual respect, things of that sort. And that, three, he said that we will all benefit when their economic conditions improve, when their educational levels rise, when their technological savvy improves. We all benefit from that. And so that speech left a tremendously positive impression. The challenge, of course, now is for that rhetoric to be translated into specific initiatives, which I think the administration is pursuing. As one Middle Easterner asked me after the speech, okay, this is a great speech, where is the beef? So we need to see a specific initiative.
What is the role of reaching out to Muslim people in the United States, in Western countries?
Yes, it's in the United States. I suppose I would distinguish between the United States and Europe in this regard, just for the simple fact that, fortunately for us in the United States, we don't have what we call a Muslim problem like they do in Europe, in the UK, in Spain, in France, in Germany, in Holland, and so on. But because Muslim immigrants over the years, over the last century, integrated in society, in our own society, and really have reached all levels of life and success in here. Now, having said that, I would say that if, for example, the United States and the UK, England, want to engage the Muslim world, that process will acquire a tremendous credence and credibility if we engage the Muslim community in this country. I mean, the Muslim community can not just be a bridge to the Muslim world, but that I don't know whether you finished reading my book, but the first recommendation I make in my book, in the blueprint of engaging the Islamic world, is to appoint a distinguished American Muslim as an ambassador to the Organization of Islamic Conference, that is, to the Muslim world through the Organization of Islamic Conference. Appointing such an ambassador would really give a tremendous signal that we are engaging the Islamic community in this country, and that we are willing to learn about the Muslim world from our own Islamic community. And the fact is that when Muslims, as they have done in this country, when they have economic opportunity, educational opportunity, they rise to new levels, as the Pew poll a couple of years ago showed when they interviewed American Muslims. That poll showed that, on the whole, American Muslims are better educated than the average public, have a higher income, per capita income, than the average American, and that's because of their hard work and the availability of opportunity. So the president in his Cairo speech said, this type of opportunity, if it is present in many Muslim countries, then we will all benefit from it.
You mentioned before that even terrorist organizations are having trouble recruiting people, and on the more what you might call middle class and educated level, there are people who are really reframing their points of view as well, and some of them are even turning to Sufism for their religious expression. Say more about that.
Well, there is a rise in this Sufi trend. Now, Sufism is a trend in Islam that has been there for many, many centuries, really from the Middle Ages, and basically shuns politics. That it says Islam as a faith is a personal relationship between humanity and God. That it is not political, that there should not be a political state, should not be Islam as a religion, should not be involved in politics, that you, if you want to become a better Muslim, that you should be a better person individually, personally, at the personal level, and not at the community level or the political party level. So they advocate shunning politics, not getting involved in politics. That's one. And two, therefore, it does not get involved in ideology. It does not. Sufi Muslims do not get involved in fighting regimes. Do not get involved in foreign policy. And that's why a number of more and more Muslims are turning to Sufism. That is, they want their religion to provide a moral compass for them and their families, and guide their behavior to be better human beings. But they don't want to be associated with the political aspects of the religion. And so Sufism is beginning to take root among more and more Muslims. And in fact, even some regimes are turning to Sufism because they are trying to use it as an antidote to activist Islam or political Islamic activism.
I have to say, when I listen to what you're saying and read what you've written, it really seems to me that if the world as a whole were to share its wealth and resources in a fair manner, most of this would just go away if there were a sharing of resources and genuine democracy.
Well, that is exactly true. And cooperation, you see. I mean, not just a kind of a lone ranger, you see, and trying to redo the world in our own image. I mean, many religions have similar views. Other countries are interested in just leading a better life. And so cooperation with other countries on common interests, I think, will go a long way toward resolving world conflict. And I don't mean to be, you know, Pollyannish here, or I'm afraid I'm kind of a hard-headed realist, but this is a fact about what we have seen in the last 8 years, is that non-cooperation, going it alone, and using the gun first, shooting